Welcome to the podcast series Us and Them, brought to you by Heidelberg University's Graduate School for Humanities and Social Sciences. Tune in for thought-provoking interviews with experts in different fields, from the social sciences to the humanities, from law to economics.
Us and Them.
Hello and welcome. HGGS podcast series Us and Them, provided by University of Heidelberg. Heidelberg Graduate School for Humanities and Social Sciences. Today, we are really happy to have our guest, Alberto Carballo Soca from Faculty of Psychology, University of Havana. Welcome, Alberto.
Hello, Sinan, and thank you for this invitation. And thank you and Laura for this initiative to bring this podcast to talk about our research.
Today, we have a plan of talking about three different topics, but Alberto has promised us that there will be links between these three topics, which might seem at first glance a bit different from each other, unrelated from each other. But the first topic is group cohesion and educational inclusion in school groups. The second one is digital education, and the third one is AI literacy. But before delving into the fundamentals of these topics, I'd like to give you a short background information of Alberto Carballo Soca. He has a bachelor degree in psychology from the Faculty of Psychology, University of Havana, Cuba, in 2020, then a master's degree in educational psychology, Faculty of Psychology, University of Havana, Cuba, in 2022. Another master's degree, the second degree, in virtual education from the National Center for Distance for Education, University of Informatic Sciences in Cuba, in 2024. He worked as assistant professor, associate researcher, and head of Department of Basic Education, Faculty of Psychology, University of Havana, Cuba. He has taught developmental psychology from newborn to young adulthood. He is currently the main professor of methodology of psychological research. Currently, his PhD work consists of the design and validation of a scale of teaching digital competence. His current research topics are digital citizenship, digital education, artificial intelligence literacy, and attitudes toward artificial intelligence. And also a last information, which cannot really be found in the internet, he was also our guest presenter at our Summer Forum 2025 with our overarching team, Us and Them, on the topic of AI literacy, bridging the gap between us and them in the digital age. As I also researched about your background, Alberto, I saw that you were really interested in interdisciplinary topics, I guess, starting from group cohesion and educational inclusion to the AI literacy. So maybe you could explain us what was your motivation, actually, starting from digital education and then going through the topics of AI literacy.
Okay, so 10 years ago, I was a bachelor degree student on psychology. And when I was on my first semester, we had this subject, pre-professional practice, and there we had to choose a topic to do a research. That was like our first research as undergraduate student in Havana, Cuba. And then I have these opportunities, and I saw one of these opportunities that was related to group processes, group dynamics. And I think I selected that topic because maybe it can be related to my life story. I think we always do research about our motivations, about our history, about the things we can have like concerns or we enjoy. So I think my first choice was related to this group dynamics, to this, and maybe to understand my place in different groups, in this case, school groups, because, well, when I started at university, I was before a student. So I have been all my life a student, and I have these concerns about education, about the way we behave in different groups. So I have this first topic that I did research, and this topic is group cohesion and its relationship with inclusive education. In this topic, well, we did research in, I remember, in a lot of groups of Havana in Cuba, And we understood how this group works. For example, when we say group cohesion, we mean the attractiveness of the individual, attractiveness towards a group, but also the integration in this group. So there are two dimensions. One, individual dimension related to our position in the group, to our motivations, and one group dimension related to the way different individuals in this group integrate. So I was part of this research team when we went to different schools and applied different techniques like sociometric. Sociometric is like an important technique in social psychology, in group psychology, since the last century, I think. And we could look how this group were composed. For example, when you study a group, you can see that there are individuals in a position, in a more positive position or a maybe negative position. There are preferred individuals, there are rejected individuals, there are others isolated, and also there are like average individuals. So related to the Assam-Dem topic, that's the topic why we are here now, related to this topic, well, we can see that in a group, you can have like these individuals accepted, these individuals rejected, and can be for many reasons. For example, in the case of Havana, Cuba, in these school groups, are secondary education groups, you can see individuals rejected by their color, their skin color. That was an important factor. Skin color or academic achievements, even the gender was an important characteristic to be rejected, to be accepted in a group. And for example, individuals of black skin were more rejected when it is related to the group task, I mean the study, but they could be maybe more accepted when it's related to social interactions or another type of activity that's not the group task. So also related to this Assam-Dem topic, we can see that there are labels that defines different group inside a group. And for example, we can see that there are some of these labels that are used to mark certain individuals related to their, for example, interests. If you like to play video games, if you like to do sports, if you like to even study, you can have a label in this group. Also, there are some labels that can bring positive emotions to these members of the group, or negative emotions, and even can be related to the way they take advantage of the study, the activity of study. And for example, this is related to the social identity theory, which is an important theory for the understanding of groups in different settings, in different levels, from small groups to larger groups.
Maybe I can also ask at that point, because when we are talking about group cohesion, there are different kind of sub-branches, actually, like social cohesion, task cohesion, perceived belongingness, and group identity. And when we are talking about these different sub-branches, they all consist of different challenges. But the challenges that you already explained actually are composed of belonging to different groups, actually. When a group is composed of different members who are coming from different backgrounds, and sometimes if we can divide them into to the different categories in our perception, like gender and maybe race, maybe as a skin color, it also creates specific challenges for you. So building on that, what was the methodological challenges that you faced, actually, in order to overcome this problem, and what were the specific methods that you used in order to solve this problem?
Yes, we used different methods. We did a mixed method research. So we applied this sociometric technique. We also applied the group cohesion scale. We did some observation in the field. We did some group sessions. We analyzed all of the information. We had quantitative information, qualitative data, that we can understand the group from a wider perspective. So with all of this data, we can analyze, for example, if an individual is accepted according to the sociometric technique, But also we have these group sessions and these observations of the classroom, then we can imagine the reasons why this individual is accepted or rejected and bring some kind of qualitative data to these numbers. So this was a mixed method research. Also, we did this research with, I think, more than 40 groups, maybe, in probably 3-4 years when I was a student. So this was a really broad research.
Sure. And also, when we are talking about actually group dynamics, there are two aspects maybe that can also create a dichotomy between individual and the group, because we cannot think of a group, of course, by definition, without the individuals in it. But the sum of individuals which creates a group actually is something different from the individual. But how do you think about the individuals who are not able to include themselves or contribute effectively into the group's effort? And how do you approach in that kind of a situation in order to motivate individuals in the group activities? And maybe a follow-up question, in terms of the technology that we have today, actually, with the increase of the AI technology, maybe, is it still a problem or is it still a necessary component of the working world, of the business world, actually, that we should still have these competencies in terms of working in a group, actually? So maybe to sum up the question, are the individual skills in rise in terms of aligning with the needs of the business world, or can we still consider the working skills in a group coherently occupies a great role in today's business world?
I would say that these skills, these competencies, are competencies that are important to be educated in school. So the role of the teacher is to, for example, if you are conducting a class, well, you can use the subject you are teaching for relate this subject with the skills, the competencies that are necessary for living in a society. And these competencies that are necessary for living in a society, like the teamwork, like the interaction with others, like the tolerance, well, it is important to educate these values, these competencies at school. And then you are preparing individuals to be more effective individuals in different settings, like the professional settings, or even as citizens. When we are citizens, we are supposed to relate to other individuals. In every context, we interact with other human beings. So the class, the school, is like a really important space. And here is when I relate this with inclusive education. As if you create an inclusive space, you are more willing to develop these skills in the individuals. For example, I remember a school where there was like 20 chairs and 21 students. And the students said, well, there is a student that should not be here in the class. But the reality is that there was a chair that was needed for that student. So, and that student had like this personal characteristic that were rejected by the group. So this is an example that when the teacher should intervene in order to develop the skills, in order to create these emotions that are necessary to interact with people that are different to us. Sometimes we see the other as an us and them dichotomy. So if we are seeing the members of our group as us, but there is one member of the group that we are seeing as them, we are going to exclude this member of the group. If we see everyone as member of the group, as members of the society, or even of our team, if we are in a professional space, well, this is something really important.
And building on your remarks, actually, would you like to maybe elaborate on What is the importance of the individual members of the group to have this motivation or to have this feeling of belonging to a group? Is it something essential actually in group activities that you have observed? And what do you do actually in order to increase this feeling of belonging to a group in terms of maybe increase the effectivity of the group work in total and also try to get members of the group more engaged in the group activities?
There are different ways. It depends on the group. For example, if you have a group that's more cohesive in social aspects, you can take advantage of that cohesion and make, for example, some activities that increase the sense of belongingness to the group, but related to social aspects. And then you should find the way if, for example, you and me and someone else in the group are interested in interact with each other. Well, how can we use that in favor of the group task? And the group task in this case is the study. So that depends. I think, well, as I have told you, depends on group norms. For example, there are groups that is more value in the task, but there are groups that are the opposite. And for example, we saw these groups in which the students left the school early, and that was like a norm in that group. If you don't adapt to the norm, it's more likely that you are going to be excluded or rejected in that group. So it depends on the group, but we have to find the way of take advantage of the characteristics of this group in order to mobilize the group towards the group task.
Just to clarify, we are not talking about one ideal group type, right? I mean, there are different kind of group types that you like to achieve maybe at the end of the day, but we cannot just say that, okay, that's the ideal group type. So all the groups, all the working groups should resemble actually this type of group.
I think it is impossible to have an ideal group.
Sure.
For that reason, we have to use what we have in our environment.
That's right. Maybe jumping on the second topic, actually, connecting actually what we have talked about the group cohesion, and our second topic is digital education. So in terms of group building activities and also working in the group, maybe it has become a really hot topic actually after our experiences in the world during the COVID pandemic. And what were your observations actually in terms of group cohesion and educational inclusion when we had to move to digital education, actually? What were the specific challenges that you faced?
Yes, first I want to tell you that this change of topic was related to data we found in our research on group cohesion. For example, I remember maybe 6 years ago, on 2019, we saw these groups that were using digital technologies in the class. So these digital technologies that some students, even teachers, were using in classes, were creating these new dynamics in the group, dynamics related to exclusion, inclusion, to the group task. And for this reason, we saw that it would be important to do research about a topic related to the use of digital technologies in the school. And then we found the concept of digital education, which is a concept that says that digital education is the use of digital technologies in learning and teaching processes, also in assessment, but also is a process related to the competencies and the education necessary for an appropriate use of these technologies. Then came the pandemic, of course. After the pandemic and during the pandemic, digital technologies became really important in the school space. So we did a research about the perception of students, teachers, family members, and administrators on these digital technologies in the education process. And with this research, of course, we found several results. For example, results related to lack of opportunities in certain sectors, or other sectors with more opportunities for using these digital technologies. And we also found interesting differences between the perceptions of the different actors of the community education. For example, students were more motivated to use these digital technologies because they said that it can make the teaching, the learning process more attractive, more interesting, better. But we found other perceptions in the teachers. They were, maybe I can say, scared of these technologies because they didn't feel prepared for using these technologies in the education. We also have the perceptions of the parents, and the parents were maybe more scared than the teachers because parents say, well, if my son or my daughter needs to use digital technologies in the classroom, then I have to buy that cell phone, that tablet, it depends, that laptop, because the Cuban context might be a context not so with enough conditions to use these digital technologies for each student. So the parents felt like this responsibility for this process. And the administrators, well, they kind of felt maybe far away of this digital education process when their role is really important, well, in order to have all of these digital technologies, or in order... Even some schools had the rule of not using smartphones in the school, and this rule is related to the administrator role. So in this case, we have also different groups: the group of students, the group of teachers, parents, and administrators, and each group have a different perception that it's at certain point a contradiction between them, and even can create dynamics between these different groups related to the use of digital technologies in education. Dynamics not always good for the group task, for the study, for the education. In this case, well, the Cuban education. We also had differences according to the type of education. For example, in Cuba, we have this secondary education level, which includes basic secondary, pre-university, technical and professional, and pedagogic education of medium higher level. It is not a university degree yet. So between these different educations, we had differences according to the perception of digital education. And for example, the students of basic secondary education, well, these students had a perception more far away of what digital education can be, but the students of pedagogic training, they had more motivation to use these digital technologies, but this motivation is not correlated to the use, to the real use they can do of these digital technologies, because, for example, the two or three pedagogical school that exist in Apana, these schools have not the conditions to use these technologies. And you are forming future teachers, so this is something really important. There are also the schools of technical and professional formation, and these schools, well, you can find since a school that prepares you for being an informatic, or a school that prepares you for being a farmer, for example. So in these schools, kind of the perception is like the more diverse perception you can find related to other types of education. We also had these schools of pre-university that I told you, well, this level were the level who more criticized the use of digital technologies. Ah, and also we have this other type of education related to artistic and sport formation. And these are, they were also critics about the use of digital education, digital technologies.
Actually, what you are talking about is really important in the framework of education, because I think, and that should be also the public opinion, that the digital education, it's an undeniable fact that we will have more digital education actually in our future, in the education of the both children and also students in the universities, and also later on education, the vocational education. So, and also you talked about this, I would also interpret it as mental blockage when we also confront with sometimes with the digital technologies, and sometimes parents, sometimes students have this mental blockage or kind of scared of using these new digital technologies. And you also gave many examples, but what would be your recommendations in terms of overcoming these mental blockages in terms of education, of course?
Well, maybe here I can relate your question with the concept of competence. And the concept of competence includes a motivational factor, an attitudinal factor. And this is the factor, the first factor, when we have to intervene. For example, if you are in favor of using these technologies or if you are against of using this technology. Well, for example, we as psychologists, we conducted some intervention programs with different actors of the educational community. And the first factor that we tried to modify was the attitudinal factor. Of course, we are always going to find resistance because, well, this is not something easy to transform, but it's like the first step in case you want to do an intervention. Then after this, you can... Maybe before you can start with a diagnostic of these processes, and depending on the results, well, you can intervene in the cognitive aspect or in the skills that are necessary to use these technologies. For example, you can find an individual who knows how to use a smartphone, or who believes or who have knowledge to use smartphone in daily tasks, and maybe you can use this knowledge that the individual has in order to develop other skills with the use of smartphones in the educational process.
Actually, you have built a great bridge in order to move on to our third and last topic, which is AI literacy, because you also talked about necessary skills in terms of digital education. But when we are talking about AI literacy, actually, there are three factors, three components of AI literacy that we can talk about. The first one is the cognitive factor, which is knowledge. The second one is procedural factor, which is the skills. And the third one is, as you have explained in the context of digital education, emotional factor, attitudes. But maybe when we also consider technical, ethical, social, and practical aspects of the AI, I'd like to ask you, how does the definition of AI literacy maybe differ when it comes to different aspects of the AI in terms of these different skills? And when we talk about different aspects of the AI, these skills may differ from each other in terms of what we need actually. But can we think about the cognitive factor, knowledge, and procedural factor, skills and attitudes as a bundle, which we need actually when we confront with AI, so that one is not important than the other? Or can we also consider that, okay, when we are talking about our AI competency, we need more technical skills, so that may be a factor which might help us to overcome our fear of AI maybe? Or do we need another mental set?
Well, as a psychologist, I can tell you that all of the factors are related. And I won't prioritize one aspect over the others because I think all of the aspects are important. It's the same, I think, with every technology. You need to have a positive motivation, a positive reaction in order to use this technology in your daily life. If you are not in favor of AI, of course, you probably are not going to use AI. And then once you have this motivation, then you can try to use AI. And when you are using AI, you are developing certain knowledge that maybe is more related to common sense. But for example, In universities right now, some researchers are using AI, and they probably have not certain knowledge that, for example, when you send, I don't know, you are a PhD student right now, you are doing a thesis, and you send your thesis to ChatGPT, so ChatGPT can give you a feedback. But in this process of sending your thesis to ChatGPT, you are kind of compromising your results, because your result now is not going to be like a new result, because ChatGPT has your results. And this is important, because if you want to send your thesis for a publication to a journal, this journal is probably going to ask you if this is an unedited work. And if you send your work to a large language model, then it is not, because it is used to train the model. This is, for example, this is an important aspect. So going from common sense to, maybe scientific knowledge of how to use AI, and of course, knowledge and skills are related, because, for example, with AI, it's like very important the topic of how to create a good prompt, and depending on the prompt you use, the results you are going to get from different tools of AI. Also, well, maybe I'm talking about different things right now. There are different type of tools of AI, and each tool can be used for different aspects, depending on you, if you are a scientist, a designer, a marketing specialist. There is an endless way of possibilities in using AI right now.
Well, you are also working on your research project right now, which is about AI literacy, and you are actually using a methodology for bibliometric analysis, and which composed of samples, methods like performance analysis, science mapping, network analysis, and also surely data analysis. And would you like to maybe briefly elaborate on your key findings, and especially the ones that are related with our overarching theme, ASCENDEM, which is the divergence between Global South and Global North?
Yes. Maybe I want to say a few words about bibliometric analysis.
Sure. Please.
Bibliometric analysis is a way of mapping science. So with this methodological approach of bibliometric analysis, you can know how certain topic is right now in the world. And in the case of artificial intelligence literacy, I found some results that, for example, most of the research is conducted in the global north. Global north, countries like Europe, United States, and China are the main countries that are doing research on AI literacy. This is important, of course, related to policies, related to if you want to conduct certain modifications in education. Well, these countries are going to have an advantage because they are doing research in their own countries. And in any case, for example, if you are developing a scale to evaluate AI literacy, this scale is going to be useful for certain population, for example, the teachers of German educational system. But this scale is not going to be useful for the teachers of República Dominicana, for telling you a country. So this is one ASCENDEM dichotomy related to research about AI literacy in this bibliometric analysis. Also, there are interesting papers on the topic. For example, I remember a paper that talks about high-resource language and low-resource languages. And these low-resource languages are languages underrepresented in the large language models. For example, Swahili. Swahili is a language that you probably never heard, I don't know. But, for example, if you look information about the Bible or another book, then you are going to find an outdated information in Swahili. And that's the opposite that if you look for this information in English language. If you look for this information in English language, you are going to find probably the most updated information. And this is another difference between countries, between languages. Also, there is this difference related to the asylum dichotomy, and it's a really interesting one because it's a way that science is creating these new labels. For example, you can find, of course, the global north, the global south, but now they invented a new category, and the global desert. And the global north, of course, are the countries that have all of the computational capacity for having this AI in their environment. Global south are countries that at a certain point, they can use these computational capacities. And the global desert are countries like my country, like Cuba, when we do not have the conditions for the development of this artificial intelligence.
Well, maybe as a last question, in order to not leave this topic actually without giving any recommendation for the future policies, what would be your recommendations for the policymakers first, or maybe in general to our listeners, in order to fill this gap a little bit more in terms of AI literacy, and what would be your, in general terms, solutions for this problem?
Well, from my background in psychology and education, I can tell you that it's really important to educate in these topics, in the use of AI, since probably early education until higher education. And not only in students, you need to educate teachers, professors, researchers, probably all the population of a country. It's important to be aware of these technologies. And in order to do that, of course, science is very important. Science is an important way of building knowledge in your context, in developing, for example, I told you, scales for determining the level of AI literacy. And according to this level of AI literacy, you can then develop intervention programs. You can create more opportunities. So I think a key aspect in every country, whether it's global north, global south, it's education.
Thank you, Alberto, for this wonderful, insightful interview. As a tradition, we are asking a final question, an informal one. And in your specific case, Alberto is a marathon runner, actually.
Half marathon runner,
I'm sorry, which covers still actually great distances, half marathon. How many kilometers does that make?
21 kilometers, yes.
21 kilometers, that's more than I can actually walk. But I would like to ask you, do your sport activities help you in order to overcome the stress of the academic life? It's also fine if you say that, okay, I don't have any academic stress, so sport is something extra.
I sometimes have academic stress. Running is part of my life right now, and I think it is an important part because when I run, I feel like more relaxed, and even it's good for creativity. I have like better ideas after I run than before I run if I feel stressed. Running, I think also nature, being in touch with nature. I like to hike, and maybe next month, this month because we are in August, maybe this month I will hike up the Zugspitze here in Germany.
Great. Actually, that would be a great recommendation for our listeners. If they are having a crisis of creativity or writing blockage, then we recommend you with Alberto to run, actually. And afterwards, let's see how many creative ideas occur actually in your minds.
Well, it depends on the person.
Surely. Thank you so much, Alberto, for this really enjoyable interview. We are closing right now our podcast episode, and we'd like to see you in the next episodes. Bye.
Thank you for listening to the HGGS podcast series, Us and Them. In this series, we bring you conversations with experts from a wide range of disciplines, from the social sciences to the humanities, from law to economics. If you enjoyed our podcast, we invite you to explore our previous episodes and subscribe to our channel so you never miss a new episode. Stay tuned for more insightful interviews coming soon.